All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of Free for All, streaming live right here on Grumblings Media every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern. But you already know that if you're here. Tell a friend or two, won't you? Have them grow the audience for Free for All. I'm your host, Big John, conceding to age once again by wearing these because I have plenty of notes and I can't read them without my glasses and the help, the intellectual help of my good friend, Mr. Hody Johns. Hody, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good, better than you, because if you need my help for intellectualism, you are in dire straits.
Yeah, well, we could be dire straits, Mark Knopfler. I'm with it. So tonight we're going to talk about a lot of topics. That's why we don't have any guests tonight. There's just a lot of topics, Hody. We want to get to as many as possible. A lot of things that are of interest to libertarians, libertarian-leaning issues that we need to sort of go through. Some have interesting, they're not as cut and dried as a lot of times when libertarians get off the talking of issues of the day. So the way we're organizing the show tonight, Hody, I'm going to toss out a couple of major topics. We'll try to go through them as best we can. And more so than usual, I would love to have your input, and let's chop it up and see if we can come to some sort of understanding as to what's really going on. So the first topic I want to talk to you about is the Fast and Furious. You know, this would be part of the movie franchise. You know, Doge, President Trump, they're Fast and Furious. Now, in trying to be fair and balanced, to cop a phrase, to the president and to Doge, let's say I am about to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that all these massive cuts, these reductions, let's give them the best of intentions and say, I think that as libertarians, perhaps, we can get behind the fact that they want to reduce the size of government. The scope of it, the actual dollars and cents of it. Now, we can quibble as to whether how effective it is, given that a lot of it has to go through Congress. So, but to be fair to the president, and which I'm often not, you know, so I want to state that, Hody. This is not a Trump-bashing session we got going here. I want to look and see what's really going on. The first order of business is U.S. judges have ordered agencies to reinstate fired workers that were targeted by both Trump via executive order and Doge as a recommendation. So these mass layoffs, the court has put a temporary injunction or restraining order against it. The agencies have been told to hire them back. Let me throw out some quick facts of the case so we all get our bearings, Hody, and then I'd love your comments. On March 14th, federal judges ordered 19 U.S. agencies to rehire roughly 20,000 probationary employees that were fired in massive layoffs by President Trump and Elon Musk, blocking further cuts. This is on the heels of legal challenges by labor unions and Democratic AGs arguing that layoffs violate employment laws and disrupt services. And basically, on March 14th, there were two federal judges, both of them Democrat appointees, that ordered these federal agencies to rehire 20,000 employees, as we mentioned. Legal challenges were mounted by labor unions and Democratic attorneys generals. But then a separate federal judge on February 20th had initially allowed the firings to continue. So after the first round of protests, there was a judge on February 20th that said, no, they can go ahead and fire them. But then on March 13th and 14th, those other two judges swooped in and said, no, let's put a block on them. So, Hody, I'll take the part of the administration's advocate here and say, hey, why are you libertarians up in arms over this? I thought you guys were part of the Malay Afuera thing. We're trying to get rid of agencies here. We're shutting down the Department of Education. Again, why are you guys objecting to that? We're reducing the size of government. 20,000 useless employees. We're getting rid of them. Hody, why do you guys have objections to that?
Oh, boy. You know, I love to see government actually be small. You're much more fair to Trump than I am, so I appreciate you trying your best, because you're going to have to pull me along on this one here.
Right. Fair enough.
So these are probationary employees and not just employees. So the idea was is, of course, Trump and the federal administration can kind of have some leeway over some of the discretionary spending, but nothing over non-discretionary. And these are non-discretionary employees, but they are kind of, you know, a probationary employee is not somebody full-time. They're kind of interning, right? Like this is a thing into, you know, into the future, right? So the idea behind the Trump administration is that they want to downsize this. And so therefore, hey, you're not going to need future employees. Let's just get rid of them because all these prospective employees aren't going to need to step in there. Unfortunately, because they are indiscretionary employees, it is against the Constitution for him to do that. It's a violation of his power. So the judges are correctly ruling that he cannot actually do this. As you would note, Reason actually had a great roundtable about this one with their two conservative, the two actual Trump voters over at Reason. And they were talking about this and they're like, see, the issue with Trump is I want him to do this thing. But he is going about it the wrong way. Nothing that he does, one, can be undone. And two is even if this goes through and say the courts decide to side with him, there's nothing to stop the Democrats then from using the same ruling to say, oh, if I can set what the number of employees is, then I'm going to set it higher. You say down 20,000, I say up 25,000, you know? And so this is a gateway, of course, for the executive to get more power if the courts don't do their job on this one. The courts did do their job on this one. So the libertarian argument on this isn't necessarily that we don't want these governments to shrink, but it's that we do need to contain the executive power. If the branch is permitted to do this, they're also permitted to do a number of other things. And remember, if Trump can do it, then whoever comes after Trump can also do it.
Yeah, and you know, Hody, it's interesting. On my other show, Liberty Lens, that I co-host with our good friend Mike Termott, we've used that phrase in the issue of the deportations. It's not necessarily the agreement of whether or not the action the president is taking is either good or bad in and of its own nature, right? What we are trying to figure out is show your work. There's a reason why when you do math problems in the third grade, the teacher comes and says, no, 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 the number isn't good enough. You know, the answer isn't good enough. Show me how you got to the answer, right? Because that at times is just as important as arriving at the correct answer. And if the correct answer in this case means making the executive branch even more powerful, which it already is, by the way, you know, for people that may think that, quote, activist judges, and we'll get to that in a second, are somehow kneecapping the executive branch, please keep in mind, for all the wars, for all the military actions that the libertarians correctly rail against, why are we droning Yemen? Why are we sending troops to Ukraine? Why are we sending foreign aid to Ukraine, to wherever? All these military actions, all of them have come basically through the executive office, something that should be within Congress's purview only, right? The president is the commander in chief, but he doesn't get to declare war. He doesn't get to unilaterally decide where our troops are sent, right? So it's not like all of a sudden people are afraid that the executive office is too weak, Hody, right?
No, it's certainly just as powerful as it has ever been before.
Right. So that's why in this case, I think you're absolutely right. Do we want to see government trimmed down? Like, listen, you don't have to be an anarchist, right? You don't have to hold the position that the entire government needs to disappear. You could be a minarchist. You could be a constitutionalist or classical liberal, like one of the other three flavors of libertarianism other than anarchists, right? Anarchy. And you could say, we want to restrain government. But how we get there is just as important. So can we get to getting rid of the Department of Education, but let's do that properly by I don't know if it's a congressional law, by congressional act or whatever, but let's get rid of it. Just to your point, the next president that gets elected doesn't come in and say, I want five Department of Educations springing up, right? We have to have a process by which these things are debated and resolved, I think, in a more permanent fashion. Hody, can you think of any cons of getting rid of these 20,000 employees?
I mean, so one of the issues that I kind of have is that unless you're actually decreasing the power of government, as soon as you're decreasing the number of people, you're actually just putting the same power into the hands of fewer individuals, right? So when we have you know, if I have a government that gets to control, let's just say, all of your rights, and it's controlled by 500 of them, well, they can all have different opinions, and hopefully I get a lot of my rights out there. If that gets reduced to just three of them, then all of a sudden, if two of those three really aren't big on my rights, I'm in a heck of a lot of trouble, right? And so when we have, you know, it's the idea of why democracy is preferable to monarchy in the minds of even anarchists, right? Like we don't want, why were anarchists so bad, or why were monarchy so bad? Why is fascism so bad? Why are tyranny so bad compared to their democratic problems? If anything, if there's any fault with democracy, it's that sometimes it tends to the tyranny, like it starts to go back on its liberal values. And so the issue that I guess I would have, the cons would be that we're really not shrinking things until we touch that money. And unfortunately, since Trump has locked in that money, and actually since, you know, pulled some strings before he was before he took office with Speaker Johnson to actually increase the spending, we actually are now going to have more power in the hands of fewer people. So that would kind of be the biggest con of it. This is not one of my biggest issues with Trump, because I do like to see them smaller. However, I do think the con, there is a reason that the courts are siding with the opposition.
Right. So you're kind of almost looking at it as a shell game, right? Like you're saying, okay, we're getting rid of these bodies, but we're not getting rid of what they were pulling the strings of, right? Like the string pulling is still there, but it's just now in fewer hands. And that actually, in some ways, might be even more dangerous to your point, right? Because now, you know, it's funny, Hody, I said this the other day, and I think it applies here again too, is like politicians, it amazes me. Politicians think politics ends. Will end when they leave office. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, you had these Democrats who were like, let's get rid of the two-thirds requirement in the Senate, blah, 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 nuclear options, because, hey, we're in power now, and for sure the Republicans will never get to this, right? So as soon as Harry Reid leaves the Senate, a majority position, in comes McConnell, more of the same, right? And Democrats are like, oh, my goodness, clutching their pearls. How can he do that? Well, now it's tit for tat. But of course, what is it, 8 years go by? Now you switch leadership again, and the new leadership doesn't remember the game that was just played. So I think it's the same thing with Republicans right now. They're enjoying their power position right now, as they should, as they should. They control everything. But they're acting as if they'll always have this, when history suggests in 2 years they won't. Right. That's just a historical fact. Midterm elections always go nearly always go against the party that's in power. So do they think the Democrats, when they see this sort of this executive order gone wild, even if it's for what we think are noble purposes, do they think that this will never happen again, that the Democrats won't do the same thing? Like, what's to say, as soon as there's a Democratic Congress or a Democrat president, what's to prevent Supreme Court packing? Hey, there's nothing in the Constitution that says 9 SCOTUS judges. Why don't we turn it into 35, and we'll just pack in an extra 26 real liberal activist judges onto the court? How do you like them coconuts for the next 100 years, Republicans, right? So it's like, I think, like I said, people don't seem to think even 2 years ahead what might be the consequences of this nonsense when you're in control. So that'll be interesting to see how this gets resolved. Hey, I'm sorry, go ahead.
If I could just add a final point to that, this is something absolutely. That the Democrats have done for forever. Look at Roe v. Wade, right? Like, they kept saying they could have codified it in my lifetime. They had control. They had everybody who had support of it, of both houses, presidency, even the Supreme Court in my lifetime, 3 separate times. But it's more beneficial to say, what happens if we lose an election? You're going to lose this right, as opposed to codifying that right. And then their voters say, oh, it doesn't matter if they lose the election. We've codified Roe v. Wade, so it's going to be okay. So I believe this is actually an intentional move on many politicians' parts. They are going to do these things that can easily be undone by the very next party, with the idea that you can now, Trump can, or the Republicans, since it won't be Trump next time, but the Republicans can now go to their base and be like, hey, nothing we did was permanent. This can all get undone next election. And then once Right. Then we're at it's as with every election, John, it's an apocalypse if the other team wins, right?
So, right. It's always the most important election in the history of mankind. Every election cycle, which I always find hilarious when someone tells me, even my close friends will be, but you don't understand. Hillary is the worst thing in the history of the – you don't understand. Obama's a goddamn communist, you know, and it's like, you know, Trump is the biggest devil on the planet. We can't let him win. Biden is whatever. He's an Alzheimer's patient. You know, every cycle now, it's always the most important election in history, which is, of course, a joke. It never is the most important election in history. Anyway, so before we go on to the next topic, I want to, welcome all our listeners and viewers. Thank you for joining us. Feel free, drop us a question in the comment section of whatever platform you're on, YouTube, Rumble, Facebook, X. Feel free, and we'll get, we promise, if as long as you don't use any four-letter words, or maybe if you do and we're in a good mood, we'll pop it up on the screen and answer your question, so feel free to do that. Okay, Hody, let's move on to topic number two, NBC. So, again, take it with a grain of salt. NBC is reporting that the Pentagon is preparing plans to seize the Panama Canal. Now, ordinarily, I might say, who's to trust the mainstream media necessarily? But this is something that President Trump himself has mentioned on occasion, that, hey, if things don't go the way we want, we're going to take back the Panama Canal. And this, of course, is of great importance to our producer, William, who happens to be a native Panamanian. So he's very passionate about the issue. So I will preface this by saying, William, I'm not certain that I got my stuff from liberal media sources, but I'll do my best to be objective, okay? So factual issues. NBC News reported on March 13th that President Trump directed the Pentagon to develop plans to ensure U.S. access to the Panama Canal, including potential military options. So, not to over dramatize this, we're not saying that he's ready to send troops down to the Panama Canal, Hody. He's just saying, like, hey, we have to ensure our access to it, and we are considering everything, including military action to go do it. The U.S. Southern Command is drafting strategies for increasing military presence and partnerships with Panamanian forces to the possibility of seizing the canal by force. The administration's stated goal for doing all this is to counter China's influence in the region, though Panama denies granting China greater control over the canal. And what's, you know, obviously the Panama Canal, one of the marvels of modern architecture, it's very critical to global trade routes, right? And by international law, the Panama Canal is supposed to be neutral, right? It should be just open for any nation to use. The Panama Canal Treaty, and I'm having trouble with that phrase for some reason, but the Panama Canal Treaty is detailed on the Panama Canal Authority website. The Torrijos-Carter Treaty is the official name there. Transferred all rights, titles, and interest in the canal and related properties, such as the ports of Balboa and Cristobal, to Panama without charge. This was done during the Carter administration. There's also the concept of the neutrality treaty, which guarantees the permanent neutrality of the canal and allows both U.S. and Panama to defend it in case of military conflict. But this type of sort of initiation of force is limited only to defense of the canal, not ownership of the canal. So my estimation here is that the Trump administration's position is like, hey, letting China get too much influence will prevent this easy access to the canal. Therefore, we're considering that an invasion of sorts, which gives us the right, along with our Panamanian partners, to go in there and make sure that the canal remains open and free to international use. I think, and again, I'm speculating on the part of the Trump administration because I don't think they've laid it out the way I have, but from what I could gather, that would be their position, Hody. Talk to me about it. Talk to me, what is the correct libertarian response to this situation? Should we be prepared to go in and defend what is a critical piece of the trade routes that guarantees free market access, free movement of goods and services that we always talk about? What do you think? Is this something we should be considering as a nation?
No, any act of war, even if we can somehow justify it legally, is not something that I want to partake in. Right. However, like, I'll try to be maximum fair to Trump as much as I can. So you're right. The Panama Canal Treaty of 1977 says that we have to, that America, we had control of the canal and we slowly requisitioned it over them. And that ended in the year 2000 until it was fully theirs. However, the document does say they have to be neutral going forward. So part of the agreement is that they do have to give us the same deal as everybody else that uses the port. There are issues with this. Now, two-thirds of the product that goes through are American. So you could say, hey, listen, we might be getting the same deal as China, but you get more business with us. Therefore, the neutral position is that you actually give us a better deal than everybody else who uses this port because we use it more often, as you would somebody who's got like a frequent flyer on an airplane that you throw them a discount, right? Something like that. So the Trump administration is arguing that the neutrality would result in them getting a discount just because they are better customers, or at least more frequent customers. There's actually a lot of debate about how good a customers we are because we have terrible loading and unloading times, but that's beside the point. Regardless, Trump argues that we, because of that increased business, should experience some type of discount and that it would be completely neutral to say you give your best employees a discount. That's a neutral restaurants do that, right? Of course, Panama disagrees, and they have a reason to disagree because they just say, listen, this is the flat fee. It's very easy to interpret it. You know, this is by gross tonnage, by number of shipments. You're paying the same thing as China, as everybody else, and we're going to keep charging them the same amount. And so this is something that will probably end up going to court. The courts, the thing is America has engaged in illegal acts of aggression before. The courts ruled that we should not have engaged in those acts of aggression. So we can hope that the judges preempt this, but usually that's not how the judicial system works. They usually wait for somebody to break the law before getting the case before them to say that they have broken the law. I would argue that this is another one that Trump would lose in court because it can easily be argued that Panama is being neutral by charging them the same as everybody else. I actually, when you link this, I actually read the entire thing. It's actually not too long, just like three web pages or whatever. And so it's got a lot of interesting tidbits about things that they need to maintain. Now, we could try to poke some holes, say like they're not giving us like there's a bathroom access and stuff on there, right? Like to just say like our people are getting the same bathroom access as them. I don't have all the details on that. I don't know. But as of now, the international community would probably view it as an act of war unless we really solidified that Panama broke this summit.
So what's interesting here is it sounds to me like it's more the U.S. being concerned about growing Chinese economic influence rather than there being a threat of China, say, somehow shutting off access, our access to the Panama Canal, right? Which is kind of dodgy, right? Because I understand that we have a vested interest in maintaining economic superiority, of course. The question is, is it moral or correct for us to maintain that economic superiority through the use of force, actual or perceived, right? So yeah. You know, I think a lot of people sometimes confuse the two, right? Like, I'm 6'3". If I walk up to somebody who's 5'4" and stand over him and say, I demand a better deal from you right now, I don't actually have to hit them for them to be intimidated enough into doing something they wouldn't ordinarily do, correct? So, like, the U.S. saber rattling is almost, is it a technical act of war? Probably not. But is the effect akin to an act of war, akin to an act of physical aggression? I would argue that it is, and that perhaps we shouldn't do that. Instead of sitting, I mean, maybe we should sit back and wonder if we're being not getting preferential treatment. Let's put it that way, because I don't know that we're being somehow disparaged at all by Panama. The way you described it and the way it seems to come off in general is, hey, we're not getting as good a deal as we think we should. And by the way, even if we're on even playing field right now, we anticipate we're going to lose to China. And that's what this sounds like, right? Like, if we even the playing field, we're not going to be able to step on China's throat economically. And that's why we demand that you give us better treatment or we'll take back the canal. And you've heard a lot of people say this, Hody, that in the treaty, and I'm not a legal, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't answer this. I have a feeling it's not the case, but I can't say for sure. There's a lot of people I've seen on X and some other spots that would argue, especially from the conservative side, would argue, hey, you know, the treaty of 1977 allows us to take back the canal in the event that Panama mismanages its operation. And you see, now, I don't know if that verbiage is correct, right? Like, to the point of, if Panama can't defend the canal, if there's a third party that, say, blockades the canal, or, you know, they do some sort of CIA equivalent stuff and take over the canal somehow. Yes, in that case, I think the treaty does say the U.S. can, in fact, team up with Panama, send in troops or whatever to defend the canal. But that does not apply to ownership. There's no taking back the canal. There's no such thing as America. You know, there used to be an old phrase. I don't know if it's racist or not, Hody. You tell me. You're the nice one on the show. When I was a kid, you would call that Indian giving, which I know that's not a politically correct term, right? But I don't know what the replacement term is, Hody. But that's, in fact, what the U.S. is trying to do here, right? They're saying, like, here's something we've given you by treaty. It's yours, Panama. But hey, now that we're, you know, 50 years into the future, we want it back, and we want to take it back. So that, to me, that's duplicitous, and I don't think that's necessarily the proper way to look at it. Is there anything you could say to change my mind?
No, your analysis is spot on in several different ways. First of all, I'll address the kind of trade part of it, is that America, by implementing what we've done recently with the tariffs, made business overseas more difficult to do. There's the reason this Panama business, there, my turn to mispronounce it. There's the reason this Panama business is going south, right? And we want a better deal because we have to compensate for the fact that we're no longer as good as business partners. What did China do as soon as they saw America even consider tariffs? They absolutely amped up their you know, they're like, sure, we'll trade with Canada. We'll be your new best business partner. They're increasing their trades with Mexico, right? All right. Over this side. And yeah, they'll use the heck out of that Panama Canal. They would love to become the new best business partners now that America is slipping on that front, right? Now, we're still about 2/3. We are slipping a little bit, but I mean, in economics, slipping 10% is huge, right? Like this is a massive amount of money we're talking about, a game-breaking amount of money we're talking about. So you are right there that there's a reason that this threat of violence is coming about, because we can't win on the market because we've implemented these tariffs and these bad. Honestly, it's not even just the tariffs at this point, because we're threatening war with some of these places.
Right.
You have prime ministers literally in tears just being like, I can't trust America's treaties anymore. Like, I have them, but I don't trust them anymore. And so I am going to seek other business partners. So it's not even it's the way he's talking about these places and invading them and going to war with them and stuff. They're just saying, you know what, we're going to go with a safer, calmer option. And right now that is unfortunately China.
How sad is that, by the way?
Yeah. Really,
I don't want to gloss over what you just said.
Yeah.
What you just said is actually, if that's the perception around the world, man, I don't want to minimize what you just said, that there are actual, nations out there that find China to be the more stable trade partner than the U.S. at this moment. And if that's the case, I mean, I can't substantiate what you just put forth, but let's assume for the moment that it might be true. Man, that is huge. That is huge, because it also speaks to the valuation of the dollar as a reserve currency. The reason the dollar is the reserve currency is because everybody in the world trusted the quote full faith of the U.S. Government to honor its debt obligations and all that, and by extension its treaties, its trade pacts and things like that. So what you just said is not to be sort of brushed off, if in fact it's true.
Yeah, I don't want to, like, I think sometimes, especially libertarians, when they talk about economics, they make it seem like the end of the world and get people to, like, you know, run up their credit card debt thinking the Fed's going to crash tomorrow.
Right.
And so I want to be clear about this. Most of this is hedging their bets. So, for example, if you used to import 40% something from America, you're like, well, hey, in case that falls through, let's do 30% America, 10% China. You know, something like that, right. Where you just kind of say, this isn't a straight plug pull on America yet. That has happened, I guess, in like Australia, but that largely hasn't happened around the world. It's punishing us, of course, but like, right. and we're feeling it. Everybody's feeling
right.
it. But it is something that is still, it's not like we haven't reached end of the world scenario yet. Obviously, Trump being a populist may very well change his mind on this one. The second part that I wanted to get as far as the accuracy of your analysis is that when you just say, like, my feeling is that that's not right. So if you go to Section 11, there is a transitory period. This is actually for the period between 1977 and the year 2000, where right. actually our jurisdiction is able to make rulings that would potentially give the canal back to us. It doesn't say that specifically, but it does say that we have the right for our jurisdiction, so long as it is a criminal offense, to work, like, to deal with whatever is going on down there. So if for some reason our courts would have ruled prior to the year 2000 that they were acting in a criminal way, they were criminally negligent, they were ripping us off, whatever it may be, and right. they had to send it over, then according to the treaty, that would be valid. However, that is listed under Article 11, which is titled Provisions for the Transition Period. When we talk about the United States of America after that, there is not a provision that would make it so. First of all, our courts would have to argue that we get it back, and then you would actually have to go about doing that. That does not exist. You can actually read a lot about this in Reuters when they do a deep dive on this. Of course, right. there's a lot of great deep dives. Take whatever media organization right. you trust about this. I honestly just recommend reading, like, the articles. They're not very long. They're about 3 pages. There's 14 articles and then just kind of a long annex at the end. So you can actually right. even skip the last page and a half. It's just like a page of reading.
Right. And the important thing there is that transitionary period ended 25 years ago. That's the other yes. thing, right? Like right. it ended in 2000. So people who are drudging this up, that's yesterday's news, literally. That's literally a generation ago. A human generation is roughly 25 years. It is one generation ago where that transitionary period ended. Like it or not, that is Panama's property. The canal is Panama's property. We just have a hand in defending it. If it were ever to become under attack, like, say, the equivalent of Somalian pirates took control of the canal, then the U.S. would have every right to say, hey, we're sending troops down there because it's ours to defend, right? So that's fair enough, but it's not we're sending troops down there to take it over again. That does not wash legally under the treaty. So that would be an act of war, in my opinion. All right, free for all tonight. Just Big John and Hody here today talking some issues. Nobody interrupt us like those guys, Larry Sharp and Mike Termod and Case Oliver and Lars Mapp. So we don't have any of those Budinskis tonight, Hody. It's just me and you talking the issues. If anybody out there would like, either has a comment about what we've been saying or has some questions they want to ask or just chime in to say hi. We're here, Grumblings Media, YouTube, Facebook, X, and Rumble. I almost forgot Rumble. And Rumble. Feel free to put your questions in the chat. We'll look at them and get them up here. Okay, the third topic I want to get to, Hody. Man, I am so glad that factions in the Libertarian Party decided to support President Trump as a libertarian-leaning president, because, you know, part of his promises, Hody, to us was no war, and we're going to get out of the Ukraine, and we're going to stop sending U.S. tax dollars to Ukraine to support a war we had no business supporting, and taking tax dollars from the U.S. citizenry and sending it to Ukraine for a war that nobody wants to be involved in. It's none of our business. Yay, Trump, he's doing that. He said, oh, wait, Hody. While the magician is doing this with his right hand, this hand seems to be dropping bombs in Yemen. What's going on there?
This is something Trump participated in his first term. Libertarians, the consensus was that he was committing a genocide. Dave Smith called it that. Legal courts recognized that this is what was happening, that he was, he was complicit in this genocide in Yemen. So this is just a furtheration of something that he was doing to his first term in office. This is not something, to Trump's credit, this is not a lesson he pretended to learn. This is something that people fooled themselves about him. He has long talked about, I think he said, something about turning like Iran into like a glass sheet and like displacing everybody in Gaza and ending things in Yemen once and for all kind of thing. Like this is not, Trump lies about many things. This is one he has not, I think people fooled themselves on. And of course he put out some, you know, I'm going to be the peace president kind of advertisement. There was one in particular that I remember, but This is just kind of right in line with him. There's not too much new to say on this for listeners of this show regularly. I'll just hit the highlights. You're required to have an approval from Congress to commit an act of war. This is recognized as an act of war in every court around the world. We haven't actually gotten a declared written act of war from Congress since World War II, John. You knew the answer to that when it came up last episode, by the way.
Right.
Be proud of yourself on that one. We haven't approved any wars since then. This is just another invasion that we are coordinating with them. I've got more to say about Gaza and Ukraine as well, but I'd like to first hear what you have to think about this kind of thing.
Sure, and I'll get into it, but I just wanted to say that let me just give you the facts, so to speak. You know, not to sound like Dragnet. Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts. On March 15th. The U.S. military, under President Donald Trump's directive, launched airstrikes against Yemen's Iran-aligned Houthi rebels, targeting their strongholds in response to attacks on Red Sea shipping. The operation involved the USS Harry S. Truman Carrier Strike Group in the Red Sea, hitting radar systems, missile defenses, and leadership sites across Sana'a, Sada, and other regions. The Houthi-run health ministry reported at least 53 deaths, including women and children, 98 injuries, although those few figures are unverified by independent sources. Trump justified the strikes as decisive and powerful, a measure to protect American shipping and restore navigational freedom, warning Iran, the Houthis' alleged backer, to cease support or face consequences. So, again, what we have here is this is not, in my opinion, the type of military engagement that the president has the authority to engage in without congressional approval. For example, Teddy Roosevelt did this once. When Congress wouldn't give him approval for military action, what did he do? He goes, well, I'm commander-in-chief. I'm going to send the Navy out for exercises, and maybe they accidentally run into the enemy while they're out there during exercises. And then at that point, once they're fired upon, he had authority as commander-in-chief to direct them how to respond, right? So he would place the Navy in harm's way and then say, okay, now without a declaration of war, we can get them to act. That's not the case here. You're ordering drone strikes to protect shipping lanes, allegedly, to protect trade interests. This is not that the Houthis decided to attack U.S. servicemen. It's not that there was an imminent threat to the homeland of the U.S. or any U.S. interests out there. This is a preemptive strike, as far as I could tell. I mean, maybe there's something else going on that I don't know about, but it doesn't seem like this posed any immediate threat to the U.S. So, again, I find this, Hody, to be like just the latest in a long line of executive overreach. This is literally the president saying, I don't need Congress. And what's disappointing, Hody, is that Congress is more than willing to cede its war powers to the president. Like, they just seem to be more than happy to say, we don't want to vote on it. We don't want to be held accountable by the voters. Because if this works out, we'll get credit. If it doesn't work out, we can always blame the president. It's not the actual congressman and the senators whose butts are on the line for this. So to your point, yeah, I think this is just another – I think it's just – it's something that – look, Trump had did this in his first term too, right? Whenever he thought somebody was out of line, he droned them. Who was the guy he droned the ISIS leader? I forget. But he just said, hey, we found him, we droned him. That's all there is to it. That's all and that's it, right?
So, what about Soleimani?
Soleimani, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right? Was it Soleimani?
Was he droned? I thought we just shot him.
I thought he was droned, but it could be that someone shot him. Yeah, yeah. The method of the act, maybe I'm unclear about, but clearly it was like...
You are right. You know, I looked it up. It was a drone.
It was You're a
right.
droning? Okay. Yeah. So, the brain still works at 60.
You
a little
win.
Bit,
you
okay.
win.
but the point being that, look, in my opinion, there's no libertarian that should be aligned with this. Neocons, they're dancing in the streets. And if you're a neocon, I certainly understand your joy right now, okay? But this is not a neocon show. So we're not here to support neocon positions when they come in conflict with ours, right? So as libertarians, I don't know, Hody, have you seen a libertarian, either what we would think are real libertarians or libertarians, who have supported this the airstrikes in Yemen?
No, in fact, I can even think of a thread. I just saw this yesterday of Joshua Smith, Clint Russell, and the Redhead Libertarian. All three.
Yes,
former,
I saw that too. Yes.
Former libertarians who went full out Trump sellout, right?
Right.
All three of them were like, "This is actually really bad." So I will say that, and this is something that even kind of the conservative base, I think a lot of them wanted to grab that anti-war mantle from the Democrats. You can sense a hunger from this, right? That like that they thought that maybe Trump was they're going to be their chance of being like, hey, we're going to be able to take this vote from them. Because believe me, Biden and Obama have no legs to stand on here, right? And the Democrats have been fully looking the other way for their guys. You mentioned why don't they do something about it? I mean, frankly, they'd have to impeach their own guys. The military industrial complex is demands that you're at war with somebody. If we want to go really deep on this, this is part of Keynesian economics. When the capitalists warned the Keynesians, they said there would be perpetual wars, that Keynes just came out, wrote the economic consequences of the peace, and promised perpetual wars and rumors of wars. And this is just a furtherance of it. Trump gets a lot of credit, and I will say, sure, I will reluctantly give him credit for not starting any new wars versus Obama, right, who started like seven or eight or something, right? Didn't start any new wars. However, civilian deaths increased under Trump by 330% with all these drone strikes. This is a very Trumpian thing to do, is to not make it an official war. You just blow up a lot of innocent people with drones. And that is kind of his way of appeasing the military-industrial complex versus Obama and Biden, which is like, let's do some invasions, let's launch some missiles, that kind of thing. I disapprove of both fully, right? Like, I think it's terrible. But this is kind of more the Trump way of appeasing those people. It's unfortunate, but that's what he's doing.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it is sort of, I like the way you said it's Trumpian, because it's not dishonest at all, right? Because no one is surprised that Trump did this. The only people who were surprised are the ones who invited him to the Libertarian Convention to speak, right? They're the only ones who are disappointed in him, while saying it's wrong, but they're the only ones who are disappointed in him, right? The Dave Smiths of the world, because they really thought he had turned some sort of corner, as if his first term in office wasn't literally more of the same, right? So while we can applaud him for saying, let's get out of the Ukraine business, let's get out of the war business, you know, you can applaud him on that, but not if he's going to conduct war this way. No authorization, no congressional vote. I just feel like droning a couple of guys that I don't like. And that should be concerning because, you know, I don't think, Hody, that a lot of Americans look at the totality of this, right? The U.S. is there saying, like, hey, we've got this technology. The Houthis don't. The Houthis are doing something, or Houthis, am I pronouncing it right? So Houthis or Houthis?
Hootie's right. I think hard, Hootie's, it's got the H, but I believe it's the hard T.
It's the hard T. Okay. So the Hootie's, they can't stop us, and we don't like what they're doing, so we're going to drone them. Now, put the shoe on the other foot, which is like, we don't like what the Americans are doing, and we could sneak dirty bombs into the U.S. because that's something we can do as a smaller nation, right? Like, I doubt Americans would say turnaround is fair play, right? Like none of us would admit to that, right? So we have to stop and ask ourselves much to, and I'm not a Ron Paul guy, but Ron Paul's right. You know, it's like when he said this 20 years ago, like, if this is the foreign policy you're going to pursue, you have to expect that people are not going to be happy with you, and you're going to raise generations of foreign nationals that can't wait to do violence on the U.S. and its citizens, right? And it makes sense, right? Because the U.S. was not in any immediate danger here, and really, I just think it was really just a sad thing to watch happen. Any closing comments before we move on, Hody?
I mean, I'll finish with what I wanted to get to, is that this is unfortunately looking like, in fact, I forget if it was between Michael Heiss and Angela McCardle. One said to pull the plug on Donald Trump with foreign policy. Others said to pull the plug on him with domestic policy. Between the two of them, they're both right. Pull the plug, right? Like, but I forget which one, but was just kind of noting that, like, it's going to be business as usual. You look at the administration that he has. These are all a bunch of, you know, violent assets who are very good at doing the business of what we would call defense or war, right? Like, and this is just – so when we see him not only threatening Yemen but gearing up for war with Iran – you know, this is, again, this is something that's feeding the military, right? He reestablished aid with Ukraine, right, after realizing that those cost savings weren't getting passed off the way he would like, agreed to pass a little off to Ukraine just recently. So that's another, you know, another thing for him. They're not only, I think the important thing, John, when we go all the way back to Panama on this one, is not just that he's talking about it, but that there are actual preparations for it. And that's right. All really the military industrial complex cares about, is that they're getting to spend money on something. So if we're gearing up for a war on Panama, even if it never goes through, hey, at least we spent the money training the troops, spent the money building the bombs, right, spent the money making the missiles, right, so that we can just launch them at somebody eventually. And so these rumors of wars that we got, whether it's Canada, Mexico, cartels, Panama, Iran, Yemen, Ukraine. Greenland. I mean, I'm losing track of the numbers at this point, right? Greenland, right? He's threatened so much violence. And not only that, but he's planning on following through with it. And so it, of course, makes the other leaders worried, but it also keeps his special interest at peace.
Right. And it very much does appeal to his base, right? That's the other thing right now. Like, he's making full use of his first 100 days, you know, where he's got that honeymoon period, because, you know, everything he talks about is in military terms now. I've noticed that. It's not, and I don't think it's coincidence. Illegal immigrants are an invasion. There's an occupying force of illegal immigrants in the U.S. There's an invasion. They're an occupying force. Let's get the Enemies Act going, right? The Foreign Enemies Act, invoked. We have to protect the canal and take it back and seize it. We have to use airstrikes. Like, everything seems to be phrased in military terms. And to me, that's a little concerning, even if it is, like many of his supporters claim, that's just the way he negotiates. He's a master deal maker. He's a master negotiator. And part of the problem is that words that come out of the White House carry weight, if not with his own people, certainly with the rest of the world. And, for example, going back to the height of the Cold War, Kissinger knew this. And that's why he had Nixon talk like a crazy man. If you read about, not that Kissinger is anyone beloved by libertarians, but when you see how he applied game theory to the Cold War, and you see that he would say, Nixon has to pretend like he's nuts so the Soviets think he really will launch nukes. We have to make him believe that he's nuts. Nixon wasn't that crazy, actually. You know, he wasn't prepared to nuke the world. But Kissinger talked him into saying, you have to – that's why they would always fly their B-52s right up to Russian airspace then hang a U-turn and come back every day during his presidency. He wanted to convince the Soviet Union that he was willing to nuke them.
Right.
Right? And that was just on words alone, right?
Yeah. Politically, this is a concept called Caesarism, where you're just so afraid of the tyrant that you don't know what they're going to do. And so you behave because you're so afraid of them. As people are finding out, this isn't working very well because there are other alternatives. We don't have a monopoly on exports. We weren't even close. We're a net importer before. Now we're super net importer, right? Because people don't want to touch our stuff. I will say this I want to step up for the Trump supporters. I don't do this often, but I do want to vouch for them a little bit. Axios just did a report of which 10 of 13 Trump supporters said this is not what they voted for. Right. And one in
meaning the airstrikes or just in general?
In general, Trump's first days in office. And this was just a couple days ago. They did a poll. You can click on the data. You can see the exact questions that were asked. You can see the people that they called and talked to. They obviously don't release their names, but, you know, you can see like the demographics.
Right, their affiliation stuff.
Right. Everything like that. And 10 in 13 Trump voters said this is not what they signed up for. And one in 10 say they wish they voted for Kamala Harris. Now, I do not want people be thinking in binaries. My hope is that if you're dissatisfied with Trump, you don't go over to Harris, who I also strongly disliked, right? But this is something I do want to give Trump voters some credit. There was a really famous town hall that went viral just this week in Washington. This is elderly, overwhelmingly Trump territory, and they were apoplectic about, I mean, just – And just think of your grandma, who's kind of politically disconnected, shows up to town halls, but was like, help me understand how you can deport somebody who's here legally. And just the audience in the room, just every time they failed this, were getting more and more upset. Just being like, listen, right. I wanted the illegals gone, but you're deporting soccer players. You're deporting microbiologists,
kidney surgeons,
you're deporting moms, dads, people who you suspect have made a gang symbol on social media when it was really I love you in sign language. Like, you are absolutely out of your minds right now. And the Trump voters, here's the thing. I dislike Trump as a person, but I understand what his supporters are going through. I think if I ever lose that connection, I need to drop out of political commentary, because my goal is not to dunk on them. It's to offer them a better, more prosperous alternative. And so I think I see a lot of hope for them right now. They are not only standing up for the immigrants who got booted illegally, but they're upset about Social Security. They're upset about the trade wars. They're upset. They are not participating in the idolatry that the left oftentimes accuses them of participating in, you know? And so I do want to say that that is a very encouraging thing, right? It's very easy to get caught up into a cult of personality. I don't know we've ever seen one in the presidency the way we've seen with President Trump.
No, we haven't.
But even he doesn't have the power to make, again, 10 in 13 of his voters say, this really isn't what I signed up for. That's a good thing.
Yeah. And what I mean, it's a good thing for two reasons. You know, one is that, as I said before, and you said it, Trump is a populist. He has no actual principles. And I don't mean that to be derisive, but I mean, like, he can't sit here and articulate to you why he's a mercantilist, why he's a Keynesian, why he's a modern monetary theorist. Like, he can't explain any of that. He just goes by what he thinks is right. Then he'll wait and see how people react to it. And if it's 50 plus 1%, he goes with it, right? Because he just wants to do what makes people think of him as being popular. So there is the hope that, much like with some of these tariffs, when he heard enough people complain that they're being hurt by specific tariffs, you saw him start to carve out exceptions, right? Like certain parts of the steel industry exempt from the tariffs, certain parts of the auto industry exempt from the tariffs. Why? Why are they exempt? You know, because of cronyism, because of populism. So there is hope that if enough of those little old ladies going to, by the way, GOP town halls, they're not going to leftist town halls and ganging up on Trump. They're going to Republican congressman. The one that went viral was a Republican congressman who was having a town hall. And you were right, Hody, it is astonishing. All these people with their red MAGA hats, Make America Great Again hats, saying, wait a second, we thought you were going to cut the fat out of government spending, not my Social Security check. not my special needs grandson who's now got his services cut off. You know, like, you know, and again, it also validates what Milton Friedman said. He said, be careful when you address greed if you're in government, because, of course, it's always the other fellow who's greedy, never me. Right? So, you know, when you're there screaming at that, yay, Doge, go Doge, it's never with the intention of, but wait a second, the stuff I get from government is legit. The stuff those other people get is illegitimate. We have to get rid of that. And when it comes around, I can guarantee you 99 times out of 100, when it comes around and that Doge axe swings your way, all of a sudden it's not fair anymore. Now, I'm not arguing to maintain big government, but if you're someone like Trump and Musk, who's taking an axe to things and being ruthless about it, you have to expect this sort of like reaction even from your supporters. And I think that's something that they run a risk with, because Trump is letting Musk run the government like a startup, right? So what's Musk famous for? He buys Twitter, fires 80% of the staff, sees that things are running sort of like the Pareto principle, like 80% of it is running smoothly. Then he hires back a few key people because he could do that. You know, when you're that small a company, you could be nimble. Guess what? There's nothing nimble about the U.S. government. It's the Titanic times two. It's like the Titanic tugging the Lusitania along behind it. You're not going to be entering any races. There's no sharp turns you can make. Everything is a gradual one half of 1 degree steering in either way for the Navy men out there, right? So I think I think people right now, it's going to be a test of their MAGA resolve. We cheered for this. We're the ones who voted for this. Can we put up with the cuts? Can we put up with the airstrikes? Can we put up with the non-consulting of Congress and so on? So it'll be interesting, Hody, as we go along to see how much that support for Trump either maintains or dissolves away. Let's go to the comments very quick before we go to our last topic. David Rash? I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, David, but he just gave us a drum roll. So thank you very much for the drum roll. We appreciate you watching Free For All. Also, we have a comment from Tom Duke, who I can't tell in his avatar, Hody, if he's enjoying like an Arizona iced tea or some other sort of beverage. But it's a good avatar. He's enjoying a beverage while he's watching Free For All. He says, boo for Rump's agenda thus far. Well, you know, Tom Duke, being libertarians, I think, Hody, you'll agree, most of the time we may not be 100% aligned with the president, but we are willing to give him credit where when he does do something that aligns with our vision of things like freeing Ross, like cutting the Department of Education, which has been a tremendous waste of resources and time and has done not a thing to help students in this country. All right. Hody, as we wrap up the show, there was an interesting, you know, we get our followers on X who drop us a note on occasion, and some of it is combative, some of it is complimentary. You know, we run the whole gamut, Hody. So I want to take a shout out. Hold on, let me get the gentleman's name right. I think it's a gentleman. We're talking about J.J. Harper, and his X handle is @CreekAndHoller. And he turned us on to an article in the Bulwark. And I want to get your opinion on this. You're the book guy. You're the book club guy. You're the reader. I'm the lazy old man. I don't read anymore, so I want your expert opinion on this. You know, he posited that guys, the techno bros like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Mark Andreessen, they kind of view themselves to some extent, and certainly their followers view them as heroes, as the protagonists of Atlas Shrugged, that there's some sort of Randian, they jump off the page and they're Ayn Rand's heroes, you know, these hard-nosed capitalists who believe. And this article in the Bulwark that J.J. Harper turned us on to is saying kind of the opposite, isn't it?
Yeah. I am a big fan of Ayn Rand, and that may surprise some people because I kind of come off as like a leftist century kind of libertarian. And she's generally, I'm an anarchist. I'm aware that she has all the quotes about anarchists being terrible or whatever. You don't need to show me those. But I do consider myself like a fan of objectivism, even if I'm not like a full objectivist. I do believe in assessing what is real and what works and kind of going with what is real and what works. Without Ayn Rand, I think it was 30 years ago, and I was reading about the state of the Libertarian Party at that time. This was during the paleo movement. And 76% of registered libertarians were atheist objectivists with Randian influence. 76%, over 3 in 4 libertarians at that time were atheist objectivists, largely because of the influence, of course, of Ayn Rand. And that was kind of what led them to liberty. So it's hard to argue that, like, I don't know what the state of the liberty movement would be in this country without Rand. That said, anybody who has read Atlas Shrugged and thinks that John Galt is anything like Elon Musk, you've been smoking as much weed as Mr. Musk has, and maybe lower that dose on the ketamine just a touch, because it's very different. One of the things that I noticed, one of the just the ideas that pops off in my head immediately, is in the first part of the book. The book's, of course, in 3 parts. And with the first part, when she's doing business with Henry Reardon, and he gives her that what she needs, Dagny Taggart, of course, the protagonist, for free to help. Because he's like, listen, I don't have a business if you don't have a business. These people are the ultimate in cooperation. They don't see, like, it is competition. Sometimes they're side by side. You see that when we actually get to Galt's Gulch. But you see how that competition makes each other better and how they are interested in seeing each other succeed in a largely cooperative society, as well as a society in which they say, you know what, if it's government touched, I don't want anything to do with it. I don't want their regulations. I don't want them to touch it. Right. And then we see what the RFKs are doing as far as regulations, and we hear cheering, right? Like, hey, at least it's the good regulation kind of thing. No, this is not Ayn Rand at all. This is the opposite of Ayn Rand, right? I mean, these people would have, there was some notes this week that these people would have easily deported Ayn Rand, right? Back to Russia for sure.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but 2 points on what you're saying. One is the same people who are quoting Rand. From some northeast corners of this country, Rand herself was an immigrant who would not have supported the mass deportations. Of course, she probably would have supported no welfare, no altruistic motives for keeping them here, right? But if people came here to work and to succeed on their own, she was 100% down with that, being a Russian immigrant as a young girl when she came here to escape the Bolsheviks and the communists. And for people to think otherwise, I think is silly. And also the other thing is her objectivism, while she did say altruism is the worst thing that a man, what was it, Hody the quote, a man should not strive to be in service to his fellow man or something to that effect. I think the point that you made that's very salient is the cooperative point. As a libertarian, it's not necessarily the Rand objective to be a cutthroat son of a bitch looking to screw over the competition at every turn. It is that cooperative nature. Like, I've got steel, you've got a railroad, this is perfect. We should be working together. Yes. We don't need the government to be our broker, correct?
Yeah, we tend to kind of take Ayn Rand in such a heartless direction, because the altruism quote, the basic principle of altruism is that a man has no right to exist for his own sake, right? And she talked about the virtue of greed, right? Like the virtue of selfishness, I think. And the idea that being selfish is good. Points that I do disagree with her on, by the way. But that being said, who are the villains in Atlas Shrugged? They're wealthy. They're connected to political power. They're making it possible for people to do business here and anywhere else. Two of Ayn Rand's biggest issues, if you were to like point to just 2 issues that she had, if you were familiar with the overall work with Ayn Rand, huge problem with racists, huge problem with liars. Can't stand, like, for her, lying was the equivalent of like breaking a contract. Right. Like, right. Our word is our bond. If we promise things, we have to deliver them. What did the Trump administration just do last week in trying to stop payments to work that had already been done? Right. Like, this is literally fraud. Right. This is the type of thing that these were the villains in Ayn Rand's stories. So, I mean, John, I know that, like, you read this, you had a lot of thoughts about it and some passion about it. I, obviously, loving Ayn Rand and seeing this as well, found this article to be really informative. But I kind of want to get your thoughts as far as what you think about Ayn Rand and objectivism, the article itself, and, like, do you see Elon Musk as, like, in the spectrum of, like, between good guy and bad guy? Peter Thiel, Mark Andy, yeah. Like, you know, and by all these guys, how do you see him?
Well, now I'll talk specifically about Musk and Andreessen, because those are the two I'm most familiar with. Now, Thiel I know about tangentially, but to be honest with you, I've never followed his work. Andreessen, like, I've known about since the mid-90s with the whole Netscape browser and everything, you know, the Mozilla browser and all that. Musk, obviously, you know, his reputation precedes him. My impression of them is they're super nerdy, smart tech bros that are looking for something that helps explain their existence insofar as the way they operate. Now, they don't want to view themselves, they don't view themselves like most of us as bad people. They view themselves as good people. So when you start to search around for things, what philosophy out there puts you in the best light? It, by the tenets of that philosophy, right? For them, it might be objectivism, or at the very least, it might be their interpretation of the Randian philosophy. Now, Ayn Rand herself, I was never a big fan of, right? As a matter of fact, I could say that I kind of reject objectivism as a philosophy, but where I give her tons of credit is as an economist, believe it or not. Like really? I view her up on the level with Hayek and Milton Friedman in terms of the her economic viewpoints and her basic tenets of freedom and liberty. I'm 100% aligned with. When you get into the philosophy stuff of it, I'll walk away from that part of it. But the other part of it, I'm very much aligned with. I see a lot of things in Musk that on the one hand, I'll say, hey, the dude knows what he's talking about. Like, even though he's a post machine, like, he'll throw in those Milton Friedman quotes and he'll apply them, in my opinion, properly. So you're like, well, this guy can't be all that bad, right? Like, he's quoting Uncle Milty. He's got the economic principles correct. I can align with him on that. Other things I don't like the open disdain for people, which is very much the sign of a genius, by the way, right? I mean, there have been these psychological studies that when your IQ reaches a certain level, like I think it's above 170, 180, something like that, when you get into that stratosphere, you become almost psychopathic. There's a huge correlation, right, between psychopathy, insanity, like think of someone like Bobby Fischer. Like as you reach that IQ scale of 170, 180, 190, and, you know, it's not linear at that level. It's very exponential. You know, like the 10 points from 170 to 180 is like going from 80 to 120 or whatever. You know, it's not a linear scale. So when you're that smart, there has been this sort of tie-in to psychopathy and things. And what troubles me about Musk is I don't know that he understands how the world around him works. Now, some people jokingly refer to that he might be autistic. I don't know that he is or isn't. I mean... being the parent of someone with autism, I don't see it in Musk. Like, I see traits, but I wouldn't call him autistic. I think it's more that he's disconnected from society in the way that we might be connected to society. Same thing for Andreessen to some extent, although I think to a lesser degree. I think Andreessen doesn't have that sort of – he's more tied into society, in my opinion, than Musk. So does it surprise me that they may view themselves as versions of John Galt? It doesn't surprise me. Do I think they're John Galt? No, I don't. I really don't. Because, and I hate to say this, I don't think a John Galt would have thrown in with a Trump. Just as I don't think a John Galt would have thrown in with Kamala Harris. Do you know what I mean? I don't think either one of those guys represent the type of objectivism or liberty that Galt represents. You know what I mean? I just don't see that by that association alone, aside from everything else they may be doing. I don't know. That's just sort of my interpretation. But I thought it was an interesting article in the sense that it kind of phrased it that way because I had never really seen anybody else sort of make that connection that maybe these tech bros view themselves as heroes in Atlas Shrugged. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a. I would encourage anybody who wants to read the book. I loved the book. Maybe I'm the weirdo here that likes these kind of books.
I caught the 6-hour movie. You know, there was a 6-hour movie in like 3 installations, I think. It's a very long, drawn out movie for Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. But it can be tedious. But yeah, if you can find the time, yeah, absolutely.
But you look at, like, the good that these people do on their way to making the buck. And maybe Ayn Rand says, like, making the buck is the point and helping people is just how you have to do it, right? Like, that was kind of the virtue of selfishness in her mind, that you're providing a good for people that makes their lives better. I mean, in the book, they're, like, bringing people water. The trains are getting supplies through to people who are starving to death and hungry and whatnot. And yeah, maybe Rand says like it's for the dollar as opposed to like, oh, it's goodness for its own sake or something like that. But regardless, it's the good guys who are doing these good things and the bad guys that are trying to stop them from doing these good things. And so you just need to look at like who is standing with the least of us, regardless of whether if we think they're trying to make a buck off of them or not, who is standing with. You know, you look at the state of the towns in Atlas Shrugged that are drying up and dying. You look at the people who are hungry and suffering and in need of, I mean, you know, the immigrants and people that they help in Atlas Shrugged. And you just ask, is this the administration? Are these the people that are helping those people like in Atlas Shrugged? Or is this James Taggart? Is this the villain? As the article suggests, is this the villain Taggart who just brags about destruction and like, oh, I'll deport you. I'll get rid of you. I'll crush this. Anybody who stands in my way better get out of the way. And the destruction is the good guys notoriously don't even think about the villains. There's hardly even an antagonist in the book because they are so focused on just doing good that the villainy is just, it's an afterthought. You know, and I see these people as kind of not really understanding their role. If they want to be the protagonist, you got to do good guy stuff. You know, it's kind of a big part. And doing good guy stuff means saving a lot of the hungry, saving a lot of the poor, you know.
Right, right. Thank you, Odie. That was a great little analysis. And I was just interested in it. I came across it again. Shout out to J.J. Harper on X. What was the handle again? It was... where is it, Hody? I moved off the note here. I want to give him his props. J.J. Harper at Creek and Holler on X. I want to give him his shout out on that. All right, Hody, before we wrap up, there's a couple of comments to get to. Our friend Angela TC says, it's amazing to me that he's already losing so much support, meaning Trump, from the libertarian side, and it's only been 3 months. I don't know, Angela. I think certainly on the airstrikes, I would agree with you. He seems to be losing some people on that specific issue. I don't know. Hody, do you agree? Because I think there's still a lot of Trump apologists that are left over from the Mises caucus and some of those right libertarians. Do you feel he's losing most of the people who supported him at the convention?
I think the majority of the people that voted for him at this stage would probably still defend their support for him. But I will say I'm with Angela in the sense that I am shocked that there is already – I mean, Joshua Smith is one who says this is the worst possible outcome. Like he's – Joshua Smith is somebody who literally re-registered as a Republican, went so Trumpy, right? And he is saying this is the worst possible outcome. So some of the libertarians are indeed pulling the plug. Angela's got a point. There was a concerted effort to take over the Libertarian Party. It was largely successful. I think it's funny that 10 and 13 Trump voters now say, like, yeah, this isn't what we signed up for. I don't know that 10 and 13 of the Libertarian sellouts are ready to say yet, this is what we supported. This is kind of how far gone they are. And I won't say it's just not how far gone they are, but this is the nature when there's an influence in your party, when there is a you know, and so when this was a concerted effort, I don't think we're too to the level, and sad to say the Libertarians are further right than the Republicans right now, but that's simply the way it is. And so we're not quite there yet, but we are definitely, I think a lot of my friends, they're dipping a toe and finding some, you know, because before if you said anything bad about Trump, they'd get trashed. And now they find some people kind of being like, yeah, this wasn't the best. Maybe I'm holding on hope a little bit. The fact that it's weakened, even if I can't say he has or doesn't have support, the fact that support has at the very least weakened is pretty big deal because, as you mentioned earlier in the show, John, there's going to be another election, and we will remember this. The Libertarians get fooled by the right wing every 30 years. It's been cyclical at this point. We've fallen for this twice before on 30-year cycles. This was the third time we've fallen for a right wing, you know, infiltration into the party and sold out. But we're about to hit that first election after the accomplished, you know, takeover, and they're going to need another 30 years to try and fool us again. I really think by the end of Trump's election, we will see a lot of the people. I think if they went full Trumpy, as in like Angela McArdle, they're just going to be Republicans, leave, gone, don't even pretend to be Libertarian, you know, just they left. But I think the majority of the people that stayed in the party that decided to back Trump because they thought it was, at least we get something out of this, I think you're going to see a lot of regret. And that's just a guess. Maybe I'm getting too much credit for those people. I do think some of them are bad actors. I have no faith in like heists and stuff like that. But I do think I think most of them that got fooled at this point are starting to recognize they get fooled. And we're just 3 months into this thing, baby. We got another 3 years to go.
We got some fun before we're done. All right, everyone, you've been watching Free For All. I want to get to a last comment here from William. He says, John Galt is an idealized embodiment of her objectivist ideals. You all are comparing real people to a person that doesn't nor has ever really existed. Well, yeah, William, that's the fun of it, right? We're saying that there might be, because and William may not be steeped in libertarian culture and stuff. So I think he's taking it a little bit too literally. There are people, like if you look at, like if you go to a libertarian Discord, Hody, like what is it, three quarters in the name of the names in there, the screen names are some variation of John Galt, right? John Galt is the libertarian hero, right? So when you hear of someone comparing themselves to John Galt, who's a politician or a businessman, it's not that we're comparing him to John Galt. He is saying he's comparing himself to John Galt. And if you do that, that's like saying I'm comparing myself to George Washington, or I'm comparing myself to, I don't know, pick a fictional character, Hody. Like I said, you're better at books. Oh, good one. See, now that's a joke I had in my head, but out of respect for you, I wasn't going to say. But you know, if you're like John Wick, you know, if you say, I'm the John Wick of politics, right?
Oh, right.
Yeah. And then someone says, well, do you really go around shooting like 60 to 70 people a day, you know, or something like that? You know, we understand it's not a real character. It's just that someone is trying to make a statement about themselves by using that comparison. And the article in the Bulwark was trying to say like, hey, Musk is sort of setting himself up to himself as being a hero in Atlas Shrugged, and that's what we decided to talk about. So yeah, we understand that it's a fictional character, and we're not saying he's a fictional character.
But if I can offer some gentle pushback, in the preface, Ayn Rand talks about how, hey, people keep saying that the people in these books aren't realistic or don't exist. And she says, the popularity of this book is proof that they do. And so we say John Galt isn't really a real person or isn't very realistic. And maybe this is, we're going to use that word autistic again, but maybe that's the part of me. But I actually find John Galt to be incredibly well-written and realistic. Like, he's smart. He invented a thing. He's got his weaknesses. He's aware of his weaknesses. You know, he has a craving for socialization, despite his knowledge that separation is probably what's best for the country at the moment. We can say John Galt doesn't exist, but I do know people that kind of walk the John Galt talk. I think the hardest thing is, like John Galt, we must produce something that is craved.
Right.
And show the world that, like, I think that's the challenge for libertarians at the moment, is what John Galt has. He showed the world something and then took it away. And we need to show the world something. I don't know if we need to take it away, but at least show them that the libertarians have something worth pursuing. And that's really kind of the big thing on our plate there.
Well, you know, that was well said, Hody, and I think we'll end on the show on that, because that's a good way to end the show. So, everyone, you've been watching Free For All, streaming live right here from Grumblings Media, grumblingsmedia.com. Catch us every Thursday night, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, where it'll either be Hody and myself chopping things up, or on occasion, or most often, we'll have a guest to help us get across some of these topics. So that'll be great. Thank you to everybody who joined us in the chat and left us some comments. We appreciate you very much for doing so. Don't forget, catch my other libertarian shows, Liberty Lens. It drops every Thursday morning, where that's me and Mike Termott picking one issue and focusing it on it per episode. So catch that right here, Liberty Lens. Also, my interview show, The Big Questions with Big John, that's where it's a biographical show, long form, 60 to 90 minutes. And this week, Hody, we had a very interesting guest. It was actually a lot of fun interviewing this guy. So a lot of people know him as Kane, the big red machine from the WWE, a pro wrestler, otherwise also known as the mayor of Knox County, Glenn Jacobs. Super one-hour interview with him. Check that out on The Big Questions of Big John, where he talks about the influences where he actually came to libertarianism. It's a great story, so tune into that if you can. Until next time, Hody, by the way, before we go, tell folks where they can find you and some of the things you're up to.
You bet. Thursday nights on the Political Free-for-All with Big John and Grumblings Media. I believe I might have a chat with William Del Pilar on the Red, White, and Rude podcast, where we might talk some Assassin's Creed Shadows coming up. Mm. One of my favorite franchises that has kind of lost its way, and this may be a big return for them. I'll save that surprise for those who choose to tune into that episode. I am with the Love First Christians. I've largely left the political realm outside of these kind of fun discussions because I like talking with Big John, frankly. But I'm on the Christian side. I have the Love First Christians. Gone through a lot of big changes this last week. We're kind of looking to a lot of the future right now. And all these changes provoked because we're getting bigger, better. The community's doing really well. We're reaching a lot more people to the point where I kind of am having trouble keeping up. So I need to bring a lot of friends in with it. That said, you can find an invitation to that on my Discord if you're interested in kind of a love first, culturally welcoming place for Christians to be. We'd love to have you in that digital space. Totally free. It's our blessing to have you. And you don't need to do anything for us. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm up to. Thank you very much for having me, as always, Big John.
Okay, and we'll catch you again next week, Thursday, on Free For All. Until then, peace, everyone.